power in the ancient world. This week on Soundings, I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with Richard Green of the University of Sydney and Graham Clark of the Australian National University. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Although the Greek influence on modern politics and culture is the object of debate among contemporary scholars, nearly all of them agree that it was the Greeks who invented what people in the West now call theater. Spanning the period between 500 years before the Common Era and Byzantine times, Greek drama dealt with themes of social and personal importance. But what did Greek theater look like to the people who produced it and watched it in those bygone days? One scholar at the National Humanities Center is working to answer that question. Richard Green teaches at the University of Sydney. I asked him to reflect on the originality of Greek drama. Is there anything in modern theater, for example, that the Greeks didn't do or invent? Richard Green.
In a cultural sense, I guess very little. Obviously, there are all sorts of technical things.
Yeah.
Pericles didn't broadcast on the radio. I think, really, one can do no better than recall a phrase from that great French theatre person, Louis Jouvet, who once said, in a slightly cynical way, perhaps, once man discovered he had to find out about the mystery of his existence, he invented theatre.
You said before our taping session, Dick, that theatre for the Greeks was a part of the cultural scene. It was just as natural as breathing. Tell me about the place of the playwrights and the actors. I mean, were these special categories of people who had special status in Greek society?
This varied enormously through time. In origin, in the early 5th century, theatre was invented as something for Athenians, created by Athenians.
Rich people, in other words.
Well, the writers, I think, probably were, because if you think about it, you have to be reasonably well off not to spend all your day working, whether in the fields or doing manufacturing jobs to earn your living.
Uh-huh.
And writing a play or group of plays takes time. And then, of course, there's the expense of things like papyrus that you might want to put it onto. And that was not inexpensive, at least for the ordinary man. And so we find within the 5th century that the key playwrights, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, were people of good family.
What about the audiences? How do we characterize the people who saw these productions?
It was basically the whole community. Now, whether that included women is a matter of debate.
But what, you mean they would have deliberately been excluded?
It's possible.
Uh-huh.
I believe that women did attend the theater and regularly, but it's an open question.
Well, aren't there Greek plays that have what we today call feminist themes? Doesn't that tell us something about not only the production, but the audience, the consumption of what was going on there?
I think that's a very good and useful question, and one I tend to believe in, yes. I mean, by the time you get to the later 5th century and playwrights like Euripides,
uh-huh,
women are a key question.
What did they think about? What kinds of social themes occupied the Greek minds?
Well, in the earlier period, I think, let's say in the earlier parts of the 5th century, they were concerned basically with problems of man's relationship to the gods and man's relationship to the state. And it ties fairly closely, I think, to the emergence of democracy and man's place in the city, in the running of things, and a slowly failing belief in the major gods, which comes through very clearly when you get to Euripides.
Let's talk, Dick Green, about your interest in the production of Greek theater. How do you figure out how these dramas looked and appeared and unraveled on these ancient stages?
This isn't a simple one, Wayne, and forgive me if the answer sounds slightly complex. First, of course, we have the surviving plays, which make certain demands in terms of the way you can stage them, given the nature of the text. But as you know, that's a fairly dangerous piece of evidence because you can do most plays any old way you feel like it, especially given modern conditions of production. And I should add, by the way, that we have no stage directions with the texts.
Wait, you mean just the dialogue itself?
Yeah, the dialogue. We have no stage directions that seem to go back to original production.
Does this mean that the Greeks were not sophisticated theatrically, or that we're making assumptions about the way it should be done?
No, the point is, I think, that the playwright was there to direct the first performance himself, and so he had it all in his head. He didn't need to leave written instructions about how to do it.
Is there a line between what we would call the oral tradition and when plays came to be written down? Does your study take you in that direction?
Very much so. I think this is one of the key factors, that theatre was created at a transition point from an oral culture to a literary or literate culture. And so they had an audience that was used to learning and listening through the spoken word. You know, to the spoken word.
How did these things get passed along? I mean, was it a larger capacity for human memory than what we have today with all of our books and word processors? And
I think that there was a very strong popular tradition, and people could clearly remember key passages from plays. Uh-huh. I think the plays survived, though, through first, rather as in the case of Shakespeare, the texts being given to troops of actors
Who went about
Greece and Italy and so on, performing these plays. And it was only rather later on, let's say some way into the 4th century, fairly well down the 4th century, that there was any conscious attempt to collect the great plays by the great masters.
All right, now we've got the literary evidence, as it were. There's also a good bit of archaeological evidence that you work with. Tell me about that.
Yeah, this is where I really come in. Because for some years I've been collecting archaeological evidence of various kinds. In part, of course, the theatres themselves as archaeological monuments. But then it was the Greek habit to put things reflecting theatre, whether pictures of scenes from drama, pictures of actors, or simply reproductions of masks on pots, on mosaics, on wall paintings, you name it, you're always likely to find theatrical material cropping up.
This is sort of like a collection of modern movie posters, is it not? Specific emblems about specific productions and theatrical themes?
Some parts of it are, but add to that putting it on your coffee mug or your dinner plate, reproductions of masks hanging on your wall. It's a whole culture.
Were the actors celebrities in the way that we would know the idea of celebrity today? Who were the stars, the producers, the directors, the actors?
This changed quite clearly through time. In the early years, it seems to have been the playwrights. We're told, acted in their own plays early on. Uh-huh. They were their own actors. But already by Sophocles, there's a strong suggestion that he wrote plays with his actors in mind so that they could create tour de force.
The star system.
Yeah, the star system. And then that evolves more and more as you go into the 4th century, so that by the time you're well down in the 4th century, actors are superstars. They collect money, big money.
You have written, Dick Green, that in the largest of generalities here, that Greek theater existed so that Greek society could know itself and know its gods, its sort of internal social mechanisms, and then everything that we call the supernatural. Is there a dividing line between that supernatural world and what we would call religion? Did the Greek theater serve a religious function?
In some ways, yes. The festivals at which plays were performed were very often festivals in honor of a god, particularly Dionysus, who had a very strong role as god of theater.
Was this to keep this god at a distance and happy, or was it a...
It was to honor him. But of course, there's no dividing line between the religious world and the secular world, and the whole thing shades over. But one clear function, but very particular function of theatre as time goes by, once you get down to the time of Alexander the Great and so on, is that Dionysus as god of wine is closely linked with Dionysus as god of theatre in the popular mind, so that when you're putting on a dinner party with its following drinks, when you're putting on the classic symposium, you try to recreate in your dining room the sanctuary of Dionysus. And you do this by having reproductions of masks and garlands and all this kind of thing that, hanging around your dining room, evoking Dionysus.
How long did these festivals last? I mean, what circumstances produced them? Was this the end of, a long period of work and a transitional element in Greek society? What?
I guess so. We have no written records that tell us how far these sorts of festivals go back, and one can only guess. But most of them seem to have had their origin in agricultural festivals, perhaps. But they're also put on at times of year when you don't have to work in the fields, and they might last for 3-5 days.
Would ancient Greek theater, as you see it and put the evidence together about it, Dick Green, would it make sense to a modern audience? I mean, assuming that the language barrier has been broken down, would it look like theater to us today in the 1990s?
I think it would. We have to realize that all theatre exists by and through the conventions we establish for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, nowadays we're prepared to go and sit in a darkened hall and watch a lighted box at the other end,
right,
which in some ways is terribly unrealistic. Similarly, there, people wearing masks and for serious drama, very often this chorus, as it's called, of people singing and dancing might seem very strange to us, and it's something that modern producers find very difficult to cope with. On the other hand, I think there are eternals there that we would pick up on.
The masks in the ancient world have their analogs in the special effects and the makeup of the modern world. Is that a fair statement?
I think so, but certainly in the early stages, the masks had a very real function in helping the actor submerge his own personality into that of the part played.
Have any of these masks survived? I mean, how, Dick Green, do you know really what they looked like? Is it ancient archaeology that you rely on here?
Yeah, it is. We assume that they were made of stiffened linen or something like that. Clearly, they were lightweight. They covered most of the head, as we can see from pictures and from reproductions in clay and this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But to come back to our earlier point, they were a piece of equipment that came right over the back of your head, almost like a helmet coming over the face.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. Richard Green, you are working on a project here with the tentative title, Theater and Society in the Greek World. We can look forward to the publication of this study from Routledge in London. You're a professor of classical archaeology at the University of Sydney. Thanks for your contribution to Soundings, and good luck in your work.
Thanks, Wayne. It's great to be here.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Colonialism in the World of the Ancient Greeks. Join me now for a conversation with Graham Clark of the Australian National University. We'll talk about Jebel Khalid, a Bronze Age archaeological dig in northern Syria. Jebel Khalid, which dates back to the second millennium before the Common Era, is an Arabic phrase meaning eternal or everlasting mountain. Straddling the Euphrates and covering a 10-kilometer radius, Jebel Khalid was important in antiquity both commercially and politically. Its significance today lies in its potential to enlarge modern understanding of colonialism during the Greco-Roman period. I asked Graham Clark to describe how he and his American and Australian colleagues achieve a sense of ancient social life in a setting so far removed from the present day. Graham Clark.
Well, you have to recreate the environment, first of all, and you have to remember that this area was once extremely fertile. It now is utterly treeless, and it's simply being misused by man.
And this is what, either the ravage or the process of geology?
Well, it's all sorts of things. Partly, the river would have been floodplain and very swampy, mm-hmm. would have had lots of trees, lots of bird life, lots of fish. We get beaver bones on the site, which implies trees and swamp and all those other things. The beaver is extinct now, of course, in the area. And not only would men have used, mankind, I beg your pardon, would have used the trees, but they would have overgrazed as nomads particularly came in. The Romans were pretty bad at depredating the land.
In other words, ecologically incorrect.
It's ecologically incorrect. And the result is now there are huge dust storms every year. Uh-huh. And the site that I'm excavating was simply abandoned in the end of the first century BC and filled up with this wind-blown dust over the centuries.
Why was it culturally important? I mean, is there a strong cultural dimension? Do we leave it simply at the military and the commercial, or do we in fact look for, as it were, the way people lived in a site as ancient as this?
Well, yes, one of the things that I'm really interested in is what was it like to be alive? And history, as you know, has been so often written by the point of view of the superior, the conquerors, the big people.
Rather than from the bottom up.
Rather from the bottom up. And in particular, the history of the dominators, the conquerors, rather than of the conquered. And what I'm interested in this site is to see how not only the immigrant Greeks who were dominators, conquerors, came in and lived their lives there, but how they interacted with the indigenous population.
Well, Graham, if the evidence is so tenuous for figuring out the way the dominant culture lived, how in the world do you reconstruct what happened for people on the margins and people about whom there are virtually no records kept?
Right. Well, we can see cultural contact and permeation. This site that I have, it was a Greek colony, but in very early on, in the foundation deposits of the houses, we already see cultural accommodation going on. There is a certain sort of dish, for example, called a fish plate, where you have a depression in the center where you put a fish sauce and you dipped your food into that sauce. It's a very characteristic Greek type. And we find it in the foundation deposits of the houses already, not in Greek ceramics, but in native North Syrian ceramics.
So we see some interchange going on.
Interchange, well, either the locals are adapting to the Greek market and providing it, or the Greeks are taking over local manufacturing techniques.
Was this cultural exchange from the standpoint of the Greeks, that is to say the dominant culture, was it an unconscious thing? Did they think of themselves as diluting, even polluting their own way of life because of the contact with these colonial were they outcasts? I mean,
They were in many ways semi-enslaved and were no doubt used for farm labor and all that sort of thing. And the Greeks had a very dominating sense of their own superiority, hence they built the site with huge towers to stamp an imperial landmark.
This is authority talking.
This is authority. And at the same time, they brought in, at great expense, Greek artifacts, statues, they imported wine from the Aegean, they built an Acropolis palace, which for the governor, which has huge columns, which you would see for miles around.
Why is the kind of work that you do, Graham, important today? I mean, is it important strictly to a very special sort of audience? Does it have larger cultural implications?
It has both, I think. It has a scientific edge, because what we are able to do on the site, we hope, is to refine Hellenistic pottery sequences, because we have several building phases in all the houses as they became materially more affluent. They rebuilt their houses, they remodeled them, they laid new floors, they left material therefore lower level, and you can sort out the pottery sequence. And that chronological refinement will have scientific bearing on all sorts of other sites around the Mediterranean. So it has that simple, plain, ordinary, new knowledge type of attraction. But at the same time, there is a further layout that one's looking for, and that is not only filling in a missing chapter about the smaller people of in a colonial culture, but it raises that larger question of how do people who come in as Greeks have an indigenous population become Syrians instead of Greeks and native populations? What form of cultural amalgam works?
Would you say that the Greeks, because they were colonial, were villains? I mean, how do we characterize them?
It's very hard. They were pretty murderous, as all imperial powers tend to be. They are exploitative, but at the same time, one can see their cultural achievements. These weren't just murderous vandals, as it were, but they came with cultural aspirations. And in a colonial culture, one of the exciting things about colonial cultures is not only they make new cultures, they expand from the culture of their mother colony. They become more exuberant. They release tendencies in their home culture and take off new directions.
So they weren't, they may have been, as it were, generally speaking, bad guys because they were colonialists, but they were good at what they did.
Indeed. And they formed an exuberant form of Greek Hellenistic architecture and design, which I think is terrific. They've had a particular penchant for the Corinthian column.
A particular what?
Yearning, a taste for...
Oh, penchant.
A penchant. A taste for the Corinthian acanthus, which they then carved with great exuberance, swaying in the breeze and all sorts of things. And that continued right through into the Byzantine period. One of the interesting figures we're finding, which shows adaptation to the local environment, nearby is the city of Hierapolis, which was a great cult center for Astarte, a Syrian goddess, and her characteristic pose is she's holding her bare breasts in her two hands, and she has anklets, the anklets of the goddess. And we find these statuettes on our site. These are Greeks who have adopted going to the equivalent of Aphrodite's shrine, but they go now to Astarte in Syria.
More evidence of this cultural exchange that's going on.
And we do find one of the things which my Acropolis Palace has produced is quite remarkably masonry-style wall decoration. This is a very elaborate form of plastering where you put in marble, ersatz marbling panels.
Technically sophisticated.
Technically very sophisticated. Can use up to 6 or 8 different colors in the fresco work to make to look like you've got inlaid panels of marble. Huh. But one of the things that I have found is that the floor was also laid in marble, laid in marble slabs. And I found one marble slab which has got on the backside alpha and a beta, which was clearly designed to the pattern for laying these marble slabs. But the marble itself is just a creamy buff marble. They couldn't find a pattern marble, so they painted ersatz marbling on top of the marble.
Very inventive.
In blue and brown and green to get the a nice mottled marble pattern.
On the whole, would you rather live then or now?
I'd much rather live now. I'd certainly live longer, undoubtedly, even though we find lots of surgical instruments as is an indication of the problems that they found with health. And in the excavation of the necropolis, the cemetery, what we have found is a quite common cause of death was abscesses on the teeth. You get a poisoned tooth and you get peritonitis pretty quickly.
No antibiotics.
Uh-huh. And this must have been quite a sudden form of death. And you could see where the abscess is eaten into the jaw, and away you went.
Graham, just give me a footnote here to our conversation very quickly. Tell me about this man that you're working on, Dionysius of Alexandria. Why is he important?
Well, he was a bishop in the middle of the 3rd century, a Greek, a very well-educated, philosophically trained Greek, who became a Christian, reading his way through various heretical texts, as he says, until he decided that what emerged as orthodoxy was the right formula.
Heretical because they weren't Greek?
No, heretical because they were variants of orthodoxy.
I see.
It took a long time for, particularly in Alexandria, to sort out what was mainstream and what was marginal in Christian thinking.
Well, Graham, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are a professor of classical archaeology at the Australian National University. You're here at our Humanities Center working on a project about a man called Dionysius of Alexandria. Thanks for coming by, and good luck in your work.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to conversations about colonialism and the theater in the ancient Greek world. My guests were Richard Green of the University of Sydney and Graham Clark of the Australian National University. Cassette copies of this program are available for $5. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 618. That's program number 618, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, Reason and Religion. Join me for conversations with Andrews Reith of North Carolina State University, George Marston of Duke University, and Stephen Stanley, an Episcopalian campus minister at UNC Chapel Hill. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Art and Power in Antiquity, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. From ancient Greek drama to colonialism and military power in the Greco-Roman period, listen for Richard Green of the University of Sydney and Graham Clark of the Australian National University. Art and Power in the Ancient World, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.